You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an infectious disease expert shares advice on how not to get norovirus. Now, what will we find at the very center of our planet? Our understanding continues to evolve with some new research about the ways that earthquakes reverberate through the Earth. When I learned about the planet's layers, I thought of the Earth as having four: a thin rocky crust, then a mantle underneath that can move the crust around. Beneath that, you got an outer core of liquid metals, followed by a solid inner core. But hang on, scientists from Australian National University say they've confirmed a different layer at the very center of our planet, almost 4,000 miles down from where we're standing, or sitting. Eva Golos is an assistant professor in the Department of Geoscience at UW-Madison. Eva, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about how researchers used earthquakes and the waves they sent around the world to figure out what is at the very center of the Earth?
Yeah. So what seismologists do when they're studying things like the deep Earth structure is actually pretty similar to medical imaging. So if you've ever heard of or ever had a CAT scan or an X-ray, it's similar to that. So we have seismometers, which are instruments that record the shaking from earthquakes. And wherever an earthquake happens, if it's strong enough, the waves can travel all around and all through the center of the Earth and can be sensed in that seismometer. So we can do a bunch of different signal processing to figure out what that structure is. But the deeper you go, the deeper you want to look, the harder it is to find those waves that pass through the center of the Earth. So that's one thing that makes this study really cool.
Is it a matter of, you know, if we've got more seismometers around the planet, we can start to get better and better deep readings like that?
Yeah, exactly. One of the big problems with that is that it's a lot easier to put seismometers on land. So we're a little bit limited on where we can place our instruments, but there are more efforts to instrument the oceans as well, which is exciting. But even with data that we already have, there's always new ways to look at it and new ways to use what we have to learn as well.
So what is this telling us is at the very center, the core of the core, I guess?
I guess at the center of the core is another core. The study gets, I would say, a little bit technical in this regard. So some of the layers, for instance, the mantle versus the core, are very different in composition, in state. The outer core is iron and nickel. It's liquid, whereas the mantle has a different composition and is more or less solid. The inner core is all solid. It's all iron. The difference is really the structure. So it's mostly iron. And what scientists noted was a property that we call anisotropy. And what that means is that waves that travel in different directions through a medium will travel at different speeds. So what the authors of this study noticed was that waves that travel through the outer part of the inner core are faster in one direction and slower in another direction. And that same thing is the case in the innermost inner core, but that direction that they travel more quickly in is different in the inner core. So it's sort of two shells within a single layer that we can study using these really powerful seismic waves.
Now, you also do research based on seismic waves. I think you've got projects going in Alaska, for example, where they have more earthquakes than we do here in Wisconsin, which is part of why I'm in Wisconsin. What kind of work, what are you, and you're looking a little further up than the core. What kind of things are you looking for?
So my area that I focus on is in the crust and the uppermost part of the mantle. I really look at the scale of tectonic plates. We call that layer the lithosphere, which is the rigid layer at the surface, and that is composed of blocks that slide around and interact with one another. So we can use, I would say, a similar approach to this study of the core to look at the mantle, but we use different waves that don't travel quite as deep. And we can put seismometers in different places and look in significantly more detail. We're not as dependent on having these very unique ray paths. So what I'm doing in Alaska is I actually placed 11 broadband instruments with the help of some of my colleagues. What broadband instruments mean, they're seismometers that can listen to events that happen all over the world. They're powerful instruments. And they are right now sitting in the Kenai Peninsula of Alaska, a little bit south of Anchorage. And they're just listening and recording data constantly. And then we'll go there in May again, once all the snow has melted, and uncover our instruments, because some of them are buried under the snow, and take a look at the data. And what we're trying to do is image this layer of the lithosphere in greater detail. Alaska is a place where it's really important to understand that structure, because there are very large damaging earthquakes that can happen there. And we need to have a good picture of what the structure is in order to understand how shaking might happen in response to one of these big earthquakes.
So with a better map that you're hoping to generate with this gear you're going to dig out of the snow, we might be able to say this area might be more under more of a kind of threat than we might have thought previously based on the things we're seeing?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's the goal. That's the hope.
Now that I could see that being very practical. Getting back down to the core of the Earth, now I understand this is raising questions or maybe adding insight into why we have a magnetic field on the Earth and some about how our core formed. What kind of questions there sound interesting to you?
Oh, tons of questions. The core is super interesting. And you're totally correct that the core is ultimately the engine that drives the Earth's magnetic field. And really key to that is the outer core being liquid. You have liquid iron swirling around inside the outer core, and that ends up generating a magnetic field because it conducts an electric current. And so that is really the process that's responsible for the electric field. However, the outer core is slowly cooling. All of the Earth is very slowly cooling. And slowly the liquid outer core is starting to crystallize. It's starting to freeze because that liquid iron is getting cold. And that's what's forming the inner core. So the fact that we see a structural change in different portions of that frozen inner core might indicate something really interesting about the history of the Earth. You know, what kind of processes might have enough power to really change something at the very center? That's, I think, a really interesting question. Would we be able to make predictions about something we can test on the surface to better understand this process? Some people who are more familiar with the core might have interesting ideas about that, but I think it's a fascinating and important area to study in our planet.
Eva, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yep, thank you so much.
That's Eva Golis, assistant professor in the Department of Geoscience at UW-Madison. She joined us to look at new research that supports the theory of a solid a metallic ball at the center of the Earth's core, a core of the core. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about pizza.
According to Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin, mozzarella is the most popular cheese in the U.S., and Wisconsin producers make more of it than anyone else. As Jana Rose Schleiss tells us, a lot of that mozzarella ends up on pizza, making Wisconsin a leader in frozen pizza production as well.
In a manufacturing facility just off the interstate in Kaukauna, Wisconsin, more than 30 employees work in unison on a production line that churns out one of the state's growing exports, pizza.
So today we're doing our Brew Pub Hardy Artisan. So it's a little bit of a thicker crust, which you can tell.
Matt Salvig is the advertising and promotions manager of Bernatello's Foods. He's showing me around their massive frozen pizza factory. Bernatello's produces different pizza brands, including Orv's, Roma, and Brew Pub Lotsa Matza. Marketing manager Adriana Freilich has been with Bernatello's for years, spending her summer breaks as a teenager working on the production line. She explains just how fast that line moves.
So we can go from anywhere from 60 units a minute to 180 to 200.
Each unit is one pizza. That's...
Yep, a lot of pizzas.
A large digital tracker on the wall shows that 25,000 pizzas have been made so far today. The pizza making starts in the bakery, where dough is rolled out and pizza-sized circles are cut. Just like when you make Christmas cookies, the leftovers are collected and put back into the machine to roll out again. After the crusts are baked in massive ovens, they're placed on a rapidly moving production line, where sauce is dropped on top, followed by the cheese and other toppings. Wisconsin's frozen pizza industry is big and growing. Along with Bernatello's, national brands like Tombstone started in Wisconsin. There are also countless small shops. So what makes Wisconsin the frozen pizza capital? Pizza pairs great with another Wisconsin staple, beer, and many of the state's frozen pizza brands started in taverns. It might also have something to do with Wisconsin's long winters. The numbers support that claim. Bernatello's sells more frozen pizza from November to March. Back on the production line, Selvig and I get a glimpse of the ingredient that helps the frozen pizza industry thrive.
And here's where it all happens, right here, cheese.
20-pound blocks of mozzarella get cubed, shredded, and waterfall onto the pizza, speeding down the line underneath. Wisconsin is practically synonymous with cheese. We make it, we eat it, we study it.
As a cheese manufacturer would send us shredded cheese, and then we bake it on a pizza and tell them how it performed.
Mark Johnson is a scientist with the University of Wisconsin Center for Dairy Research.
Did it melt? Did it stretch? What was the color of the blisters? How many blisters it formed? What was the chew characteristic? What was the flavor?
The research done by Johnson and his colleagues helps producers develop a cheese that fits the needs of the frozen pizza manufacturers. Johnson has seen the frozen pizza industry in Wisconsin expand.
I started here 40 years ago. A frozen pizza was like your last resort.
That's no longer the case. According to the American Frozen Food Institute, people in the U.S. ate 1.4 billion frozen pizzas last year, making it an over $6 billion industry. Johnson says there's a big reason frozen pizza businesses have thrived in the state.
We just have this culture in Wisconsin. We make cheese, we make the best cheese. You got to make the best pizzas, right?
Looking at the production line, Frelick remarks on how much has changed since she first spent her summers making frozen pizzas.
This is light years beyond where they were.
And Bernatello's has no intention of slowing down, helping secure Wisconsin's place as the frozen pizza capital.
Gianna Rose Schleiss brought us that story on pizza production in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, it's norovirus season. An infectious disease doctor gives us advice on avoiding the winter stomach bug. That's next here on Central Time. Now, norovirus cases are on the rise. The CDC says that although cases are higher than this time last year, about 17% compared to about 15%, still within the expected range. But in some parts of the world, the gastrointestinal ailment has spiked. In the UK, cases are 66% higher than the average for this time of year. Norovirus is most common between November and April, usually peaks in the winter. We're talking about the current state of norovirus and what we can do to avoid getting it. Dr. Joseph McBride is an infectious disease specialist at UW Health. He treats complicated infections in adults and children, as well as infectious diseases related to organ transplants. Dr. McBride, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Can you give us the basics? What is norovirus? What can it do to us?
Yeah, the basics. You know, lots of times when we talk about different germs, we really go into the details of what the organism is first when we're describing it. But with norovirus, it's really best to get right to what the symptoms are. And because everybody really has their own norovirus story or recollection that they have. What norovirus is it's a really contagious gastrointestinal virus that comes on quickly, usually in the matters of hours to a day or so after an exposure, and really ravages people with nausea, vomiting, fevers, body aches, chills. It goes away. For most immune competent people with healthy immune systems, leaves oftentimes as quickly as it comes. But what it leaves is this really strong memory in people's mind about, boy, I remember that time I had that terrible gastrointestinal episode or stomach flu or outbreak at a certain center. And so people usually keep that memory with them for a while.
To what extent is it really a seasonal pattern of illness in Wisconsin?
Yeah. So like you mentioned it as the winter vomiting disease. Traditionally, it was thought of been really around November to April, like you mentioned. But we can see it throughout the whole year. And we'll call the ones in the summer kind of sporadic cases. Where we see the most episodes are during these winter months. So just like you might get a cold or flu season, we think of in the wintertime, but you can still get those things come summer. I would put norovirus in the same category.
How does it spread, this norovirus? And this is a little gross, but go for it.
Yeah. So norovirus is really an incredible virus because of just how easy it is to transmit from people to person to person, and also just how hardy it is. So just like you kind of alluded to, the most common way of it spreading is what we call fecal-oral route. So this would be someone who's got fecal matter on their hands, and then whether they then shake somebody's hand, touch a doorknob, cook food, this then gets spread to other individuals. But because norovirus is so hardy and so really resistant to kind of normal things like sunlight and temperature fluctuations, it can really stay on surfaces for a long time. And we call this fomite transmission. And, I think we are a little bit heightened about these types of transmission in the setting of COVID these last few years. But this would be where you've got a viral particle that has been deposited on something and then somebody else touches it. And, I think for listeners to hear just how kind of potent and durable these norovirus particles are, things like freezing it does not destroy the virus. Temperatures as high as 140 degrees Fahrenheit do not destroy the virus. Things like alcohol hand gel and different kind of alcohol-based cleaning products do not destroy the virus. And it can last on surfaces I mentioned for days. And so if you've got somebody in a setting of a big outbreak where it's running through a house or a college dorm or a cruise ship or a military barracks, you can really see how it's so easy for this to be transmitted around. And in fact, there is even reports of it being airborne after people throw up. So it's the idea that they're throwing up, the virus is up in the air, and it could be inhaled in that way. And so it is a very, very tough virus to avoid in the setting of a high outbreak situation.
I'm hoping you have some advice for us to help us not get and or spread this thing.
Right. Yeah. So the biggest thing is kind of what we've always known about is soap and water. So unlike those alcohol hand gels, this would be a situation in which I would really reach for soap and water over an alcohol hand gel, which are wonderful for a lot of respiratory viruses like COVID, but again, not for this. So if you're in a group of people where you could be touching a lot of things, I would always err on the side of soap and water. And if you happen to be a parent or a loved one caring for a sick individual with gastrointestinal symptoms, nausea, vomiting, be sure to use soap and water as kind of your cleansing habits. And similarly, if you were cleaning a bathroom, let's say of a symptomatic individual, bleach products, diluted bleach in water would be superior than kind of a lot of alcohol-based home cleaning products.
Okay, so oh no, we got it. What's the home care advice?
Yeah, ride it out. It's pretty much the best advice that we can give. For somebody who's immune competent, healthy immune system, this will be a miserable few days. Most people are symptomatic for about 48 hours, and a few are a little bit longer than that. But you will get over it. Where people do run into trouble is when they are having such profound vomiting and diarrhea that they become dehydrated, in which case you really have to be sure you're keeping up with your fluids, especially in situations where you're not keeping stuff down. And if you find yourself in that situation and you're feeling like you're lightheaded, then going out to seek medical care for maybe the need of IV fluids. Where we in infectious disease oftentimes see a lot of norovirus patients is in situations where maybe there is an immune compromising condition, like a solid organ transplant recipient or somebody with HIV or AIDS. And in these situations, symptoms do not oftentimes abate so quickly, and they can be persistent for weeks and months. And that is a really challenging thing because we do not have good antivirals to cure the infection.
And Dr. McBride, I mentioned, you know, this disease, it's here now. It's not in alarming levels in the United States at this point. What do you watch for to see if it's going to be a bad norovirus year?
So there actually are national networks that track norovirus and other foodborne illness outbreaks throughout the country. The one specifically for norovirus is something called Norostat, which the federal government and CDC follow. And these are investigators who essentially go around and ask the questions of why did this large cohort of people get norovirus at this school or this hospital or this institution? And what they're able to do is follow numbers in many different states throughout the country to kind of give us a good sense. And here in Wisconsin, at least, I will say that the levels these last couple weeks are coming down a little bit from their high in early February. So we're hopeful that maybe we've weathered this storm and we'll be looking for, you know, smoother pastures, greener pastures in the next few months.
Dr. McBride, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dr. Joe McBride is an infectious disease specialist at UW Health. He talked to us about norovirus. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a bill in Congress would add 150 seats to the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, that bill's a long shot, but we'll find out why has the House been stuck at 435 while the population keeps getting bigger. And the origin of COVID-19 is still hazy. There are a lot of unanswered questions about where it originally came from. We'll find out why it's such a tough question to answer. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, six states and two people are challenging President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan at the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll look at the arguments behind the case heard yesterday and what's at stake. First, the U.S. Senate recently confirmed President Biden's 100th judicial appointee. The number is now up over 105. For this point in his administration, that puts him ahead of the pace of confirmed appointees by previous presidents Trump, Obama, and George W. Bush. Biden has been highlighting the diversity of the appointments, including Judge Gina Mendez-Miro, who upon Senate confirmation became the first openly LGBTQ judge to serve on the U.S. District Court for the District of Puerto Rico. She was number 100. We're going to talk about that strategy from the White House and Democrats, what it means for the federal judiciary, and what it means for the justice system in the United States. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how these judge appointments and confirmations work at the federal level? What response do you have to the pace we've been seeing from the Biden administration and the Senate? Is it important to you to see a more diverse pool of judges going onto the bench? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Russ Feingold is a former Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. He's the founder of Progressives United, a nonprofit organization supporting the rule of law and a fair-minded judiciary. He's the author of the book, The Constitution in Jeopardy. He's currently president of the Progressive American Constitution Society. Senator Feingold, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be on. Thank you very much.
I think a lot of public interest in the court system when it's there and a lot of the media coverage looks at the U.S. Supreme Court. Can you talk about the importance of these other federal appointments of the district courts and the courts of appeals around the country?
Well, they're absolutely crucial. Like the Supreme Court, which is, of course, the most important, the courts of appeal and the district court judges at the federal level are lifetime appointments. And so they are very important in a lot of cases. The Court of Appeal decisions, like in our area, the Seventh Circuit, can sometimes end up being the last word if the Supreme Court does not get involved or is not able to get involved. So these judgeships are absolutely crucial. A lot of people's lives are decided, whether it's criminal or civil law, by these courts. And that's why it's so exciting, the pace that's being kept by the Biden administration and the Senate in getting new judges during this administration.
Can you talk a little more about that pace? The president has had a tied Senate and a tie-breaking vice president to get court appointments approved. Now with one more senator on the Democratic side of the aisle, do you expect that pace to continue?
Well, the pace has to continue. In fact, it has to increase. But this is a very good accomplishment. One of the great accomplishments of the Biden administration, as you were talking about at the outset, not only did they surpass the number from Trump, but now in this new year, the 100 judges have been confirmed. In fact, as of today, we're up to more. We're already up to about 108. It'll probably be 110 by the end of the week. So this is a good news thing to undo the damage that was done by the appointment of very, very right-wing, of course, Supreme Court justices, Court of Appeal justices, and district court judges under Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump. But we need to see some faster action by the Senate and by the White House in order to achieve the real goal here, which is to make sure that after the whole game, not just the halftime, the whole administration is ahead of the Trump pace. And Trump got 234 total. So it's going to be necessary for the Senate to move much more quickly in 2023 to have and confirm over 100 judges this year to have a chance to undo the damage that has been done by the really unfair tactics that were used by the Trump administration and by the Senate under Mitch McConnell.
We distinguish often between Republican-appointed judges and Democratic-appointed judges. Somebody might look and say, hey, wait a minute. Shouldn't we just have, you know, judges who try to weigh the law fairly? Is there a way to get from this sort of partisan divide over which judges we appoint and get to something where we have neutral judges who, as they say it sometimes in Supreme Court confirmation hearings, call balls and strikes?
Absolutely. That should be the ideal at the federal level, and I might say for the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where this is a very serious issue. The American Constitution Society does not feel the idea here is to appoint Democrat judges. That's not the goal. The goal is to recognize that under Trump and under McConnell, very extreme ideologues were appointed and who are acting in a very partisan way. What we want is a legitimate judiciary. We want a judiciary that is going to decide the cases on the merits and the parties before them, as you have suggested. But in order to have that, you have to make sure that the judges that are appointed reflect the diversity of America. In other words, not Democrat versus Republican, but that all the types of people in our country are represented. And as the introduction suggested, this is an incredible achievement, not just the pace, but of these over 100 judges, 80 under Biden have been women, and it was only 25% under Trump. 75 have been people of color, and 53 have been women of color. So for the first time in our history, we are beginning to undo the historic discrimination against women and minorities, African-Americans and others that have been reflected in our courts. It's very hard to feel that you're getting that fair shake when you go in the courtroom if none of the judges look anything like you. And that's exactly what we are beginning to reverse by the good work of the Biden administration and its allies.
Talking to former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold about appointments to federal courts around the country and what the Biden administration has been doing. You can join in with your thoughts on this, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Some Republicans and conservative groups, Senator Feingold, say maybe it's all well and good to have a more diverse court, but when you're looking at an individual appointment, you shouldn't be thinking about the overall balance, the demographics of the court system. You should be looking for the best qualified judge, regardless of background. What do you say to that argument?
Well, that's exactly what you should do. And that's the opposite of what Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell did. They wanted to pick people who had one characteristic, and that was not being the best qualified, but who was a strong right-wing conservative advocate who will twist the law in a way that will reflect the very far right in this country. That is what's wrong. Looking for people that reflect the diversity of this country and realizing that there are many African-Americans, Latinos, LGBTQ people, people that have represented unions who should have been more represented in the courts in the past, and that they are ready to do it and ready to do a great job. This is exactly what has happened. These individuals are excellent judges, very well qualified, and nobody, to my knowledge, that we have supported at the American Constitution Society, is anything other than outstandingly qualified to be a federal judge.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Don is with us on the road near Madison. Don, hi.
Hi. Hi, Senator Feingold. I have great respect for you, I have to tell you. The reason why I'm calling, though, this seems a little unrealistic in today's political climate, the fact that you don't think it's that important whether the judge is going to be or comes from a Democratic or Republican background, because the way that the Republicans are appointing judges, they're just to the extreme right and will continue to be to the extreme right. So isn't that the most important thing to counterbalance that rather than the fact that to try to have neutral judges?
Don, thanks.
Well, you know, a neutral, thanks, Don, for the kind words. Neutral is, I'm not sure the word is neutral. A judge should be somebody who has, of course, a life history, who is willing to look at all the different circumstances, who is willing to look at the law and the text of the law. But, you know, everybody has some kind of a background. The question is whether they have a reputation for fairness and open-mindedness. And I'll tell you, I handled a number of Supreme Court appointments as a senator, and I saw a difference between, for example, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito in terms of the extent to which I thought they could be neutral or reasonably unbiased in cases. And in the end, I voted for a Republican-appointed person in the Chief Justice Roberts, but not for Alito, because Alito looked to me like he wasn't able to be neutral, that he was on one side, particularly when it came to corporate decisions. So I don't think it's unrealistic to look for people who will really see themselves not as part of a political party or an ideology, but will see themselves as judges with a sacred responsibility to do justice. So I think the people that we've supported at the American Constitution Society reflect that. And I think it will make the courts a better place.
Don, thanks for that call. We're talking to Russ Feingold, former Democratic senator from Wisconsin, current president of the American Constitution Society, talking about federal judges. President Biden's reaching a milestone recently of getting over the 100 judicial appointees confirmed mark. We're also going to talk about the growing importance of state courts, including our Supreme Court here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about the federal court system, the importance of it, how the process works? What do you want to see when it comes to how people are appointed and confirmed? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about the federal court system and how presidents work to shape it through their appointments. Russ Feingold is with us, former Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, who served on the Senate Judiciary Committee, currently president of the American Constitution Society. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about how judges are appointed at the federal level or elected at the state level in some cases. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's stop here in Wisconsin for a moment, Senator Feingold. Of course, we have a key Wisconsin State Supreme Court election in the works. Going to be a very expensive election, already is. Your thoughts on the importance of who is on a state Supreme Court?
Well, I'll tell you, this is a sad moment in the history of our court system in Wisconsin and nationally, because it never used to be like this, as we were saying earlier. I mean, this thing has become so partisan and so one side versus the other that it doesn't reflect at all what the court should be. And that's why this race is so important, because the Wisconsin Supreme Court has now come off in the last few years as one of the most partisan Supreme Courts in the history of not only of our state, but the whole country. According to the New York Times, this race for the Supreme Court of Wisconsin is the number one political race of the entire year in the entire nation. And that's really for two reasons. One is the Supreme Court has been captured by the use of various tactics by very far-right justices who are undermining the rights of Americans, including a woman's right to choose. So what happens is it gets kicked back to the states. What are the state's laws? What does the state constitution say? And of course, what would the Supreme Court of Wisconsin say about it? So that's one reason. The other reason it's so critical is that we used to have essentially nonpartisan races for Supreme Court. It was understood that it was sort of inappropriate for the political parties to be too involved in those. And now for many years, it's become Democrat versus Republican. And that just is not the best way to get a result that will ever look like justice. We need the seven justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court to work with each other, to reason with each other, and to try to come not necessarily to unanimous decisions, but to be able to not have it always based on who they think the political party of the person is. And I am hoping the outcome of this election will restore the court to being a real Supreme Court rather than what it has been for the last few years.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hello.
Afternoon, gentlemen. Yeah, I was wondering, is there any minimum qualifications to be appointed or elected a state or federal judge, or is it all just based on your ability to raise money or get that appointment? And then the other question, I've heard you're talking about, how can we move away from this electing state Supreme Court justices and go to some kind of an appointed method? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Let's take those one at a time. Are there minimum qualifications? Let's just stay with the federal judge appointment. Do I have to have something on my resume to even qualify to be appointed, Senator Feingold?
I believe you have to be a lawyer, that you have to have a law degree. I'm not absolutely certain if that is true everywhere in the country, but I believe it to be the case in Wisconsin. But beyond that, we have elected offices here. And people stand for office. And basically, if you're of age in terms of voting age and residency, my understanding is that you don't have to have a minimum number of years of practice of the law. You can run. Now, of course, you're going to probably do better if you're running for a high office like Supreme Court, if you have more experience. But a lot of people run for the circuit court judgeships who would not have as much of that experience. So no, it is pretty open as long as you have a law degree and are admitted to the bar, as I understand it.
Thanks for that call. And then his question following up on what you were just saying, Jimmy, hoping to see something maybe different than our effectively partisan, though officially nonpartisan elections, including maybe merit-based or judicial appointments here in Wisconsin. That would be a tall order for a state to make that switch, but not impossible.
It's been done by a number of states, and you know, I would have thought this was a terrible thing years ago, but when I see what's happened, as the caller suggested, with all this money sloshing around and the campaigns becoming very partisan and really political campaigns based on party, maybe it is time to have a real conversation about whether, instead of having elections for all these, that there would be some kind of commission. That's something that should be debated by people from all political backgrounds. The legislature and the governor would have to consider it. And of course, there may have to be a constitutional amendment to make that happen. But I think the people of the state ought to take a look at it, because right now this is not this is not an attractive thing that makes us look like the court is doing justice. It makes it look like the court is following political agendas. And so I think maybe it is time to have that conversation. They've switched to it in other states, and I think with some success.
Thanks for that call, Jimmy. Mark joins us now in Fort Atkinson. Mark, hello.
Hi there. Well, I think the elephant in the room is gerrymandering. So I wonder if Ms. Feingold thinks that getting a judge like Protasiewicz, I believe that's how you pronounce her name, is going to be more inclined to do something about gerrymandering and the stranglehold.
I gotcha, Mark. Senator Feingold, I know your group doesn't endorse particular candidates, but on the issue of gerrymandering, this is something that's come before the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, and all points between. Is this an issue you're following?
Well, very closely. And Wisconsin has been one of the most important states in terms of this gerrymandering issue. Our state legislature is grossly gerrymandered in a way that allows the Republicans to actually gain ground when they are losing ground in the entire state in almost every statewide election. So there's something terribly wrong with that. A lawsuit was brought to try to challenge this that went all the way to the Supreme Court, but lost. So now what you're looking at, the importance of this race for the Supreme Court, is things like the Wisconsin abortion ban and the Republican gerrymandered legislative maps will reach the Wisconsin Supreme Court for decision after April 4th. And it is essential that the court have a group of justices, or at least a majority of justices, who are going to follow the law here, rather than follow a political agenda of the far right. So that is going to be the challenge. And also the election results are going to be greatly affected. The rules about voting, early voting, rules about whether or not you can have drop boxes for voting. These things will all come before this court. So whoever you're supporting, people should know that that is what's at stake in this election in Wisconsin.
Thanks for that call. Talking to former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold about the appointments and, in some cases, elections of judges at the federal and the state level. Back to your calls now with Tim in Genesee Depot. Tim, hi.
Hello, Senator. Nice that you're still around and doing things. We really miss you. About 25 years ago, you spoke at our children's high school in Kettle Moraine, and there were a number of judicial appointments that were coming up at that point, and you were talking to the kids and saying how important it is to vote in all elections because you vote for the representatives and the senators, and those are the people that appoint the justices. I'd just like to have you reiterate that, how important it is to vote in all of the general elections, and I'll take my comments off the line. Thanks a lot.
Senator. Well, what a wonderful memory you have 25 years ago by making those comments. But yes, it is vital that somebody doesn't just vote for governor or president or senator. They need to go what we call this down ballot. In other words, they vote for the court races. They vote for the district attorneys. They vote for the secretary of state. Because as we've seen in the last couple of years, all of these get involved in things like how votes are counted, whether somebody is allowed to vote in a reasonable manner. And so, yes, voting down ballot all the way is crucial. Our American Constitution Society put a strong emphasis on communicating to people in the last election that they needed to vote down ballot. And nationally, it was much better. There were far fewer people who were sort of stopping right after the big races. And we're going to keep pushing that message straight through 2024 so that people vote for all the offices, because so many of them have a lot to do with who wins an election. And it also has a lot to do with whether you get justice when you go before a judge.
Thanks for that call. In our last couple of minutes, Senator Feingold, I think you're best known nationally for the legislation you advanced with the late Senator John McCain on campaign finance reform. A lot of that has been overturned by courts. We're seeing maybe the effect of some of that in the spending in the Supreme Court race in Wisconsin. Your thoughts on in just our last minute or so on the state of money in politics?
Well, it's completely out of control. As you indicated, our actual bill was not overturned, but they did overturn a 1907 law that Fighting Bob of LaFollette of Wisconsin helped pass that said corporations couldn't do this kind of thing. And the Supreme Court overturned that 5-4 in 2010. That has to change, or you're going to continue to have this gross amount of money being spent in this election in Wisconsin and across the country. And much of this is in the political elections, the partisan elections, is hidden. And so the people of the country don't even know who's putting this kind of control into the system. And that's exactly what the reformers back in the early 20th century tried to stop. So this is a crucial job of the courts as well as legislators.
Senator Feingold, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It was fun. Thanks.
That's Russ Feingold, former Democratic senator from Wisconsin, current president of the American Constitution Society. We talked to him today about how President Biden and Democrats are working to reshape and diversify the federal judicial system after the Senate confirmed more than 100 of Biden's judicial appointees. Also took a look at state courts and the current race for Wisconsin's state Supreme Court. Coming up after the news, we're going to stay in the court system. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday on a challenge to the Biden administration's student loan debt forgiveness plan. We'll check out the legal challenge and what's at stake, and we'll keep taking your calls. If you have a question about that or a thought on that case, you can get started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Also coming up, we'll take a look at a food pantry in the Abbotsford area that's distributing food and building community in central Wisconsin. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.